worth chasing. But the officers couldn't let Rufus go unpursued, not after his act of aggravated assault. So Malcolm came up with a genius, life-ruining idea. Get himself arrested. Malcolm argued with the police officer and resisted arrest, but the great flaw in his plan was being unable to communicate it to Tego, who jumped into the argument, too, with more aggression than Malcolm himself was using. Both Malcolm and Tego are currently being taken to the police station. "This is pointless," Tego says in the back of the cop car. He's no longer sucking his teeth or shouting about how he did nothing, the way he did when the handcuffs first went on, even though Malcolm and Amy urged him to shut up. "They're not going to find Rufus. He'll dust them on his..." "Shut up!" This time, Malcolm isn't worried about extra charges coming Tego's way. Malcolm already knows Rufus managed to get away on his bike. The bike wasn't there when they were being escorted out of the house, and he knows Rufus can dust the police on his bike, but he doesn't want them keeping an eye out for boys on bikes and find him. If they want him, they're going to have to work for it. Malcolm can't give his friend an extra day, but he can find him extra time to live. This is assuming Rufus is still alive. Malcolm is game to take this hit for Rufus, and he knows he's not innocent himself. That's common sense. The Plutos snuck out earlier tonight with the intention of kicking Peck's ass, which Rufus did a fine job of all by himself. Malcolm has never even been in a fight before. Even though many paint him to be a violent young man because he's 6 feet tall, black, and close to 200 pounds, just because he's built like a wrestler doesn't mean he's a criminal. And now Malcolm and Tego will be tagged as juvenile delinquents. But they'll have their lives. Malcolm stares out the window, wishing he could glimpse Rufus on his bike turning a corner, and finally he cries. These loud, stuttering sobs. Not because he'll now have a criminal record. Not because he's scared to go to the police station. Not even because Rufus is dying. But because the biggest crime of all tonight was not being able to hug his best friend goodbye.
Mateo, 3:42 a.m. There's a knock at the front door, and I stop pacing. Different nerves hit me all at once. What if it's not Rufus, even though no one else should be knocking at my door this late at night? What if it is Rufus, and he's got a gang of thieves with him or something? What if it's Dad, who didn't tell me he woke up so that he could surprise me, the sort of end-day miracle they make Lifetime movies about? I approach the door slowly, nudge up the peephole's cover, and squint at Rufus, who's looking right at me, even though I know he can't actually make me out. "It's Rufus," he says from the other side. I hope it's only him out there as I slide the chain free from its track. I pull the door open, finding a very three-dimensional Rufus in front of me, not someone I'm looking at through video chat or a peephole. He's in a dark gray fleece and is wearing blue basketball shorts over these Adidas gym tights. He nods at me. There's no smile or anything, but it's friendly all the same. I lean forward, my heart pounding, and peek out into the hallway to see if he has some friends hiding against the walls, ready to jump me for the little I have. But the hallway is empty, and now Rufus is smiling. "I'm on your turf, dude," Rufus says. "If anyone should be suspicious, it's me. This better not be some fake sheltered kid act, yo." "It's no act," I promise. "I'm sorry, I'm just on edge." "We're in the same boat." He holds out his hand, and I shake it. His palm is sweaty. "You ready to bounce?" This is a trick question, obviously. "I'm ready-ish," I answer. "He's come straight to my door for my company today, to lead me outside my sanctuary so we can live until we don't. Let me grab a couple of things." I don't invite him in. nor does he invite himself inside. He holds the door open from the outside while I grab the notes for my neighbors and my keys. I turn off the lights and walk past Rufus, and he closes the door behind me. I lock up. Rufus heads toward the elevator while I go the opposite way.
Where are you going?
I don't want my neighbors to be surprised or worried when I'm not answering. I drop off one note in front of 4F. Elliot cooked extra food for me because I was only eating waffles. I come back Rufus's way and leave the second note in front of 4A. And Sean was going to take a look at our busted stove, but he doesn't have to worry about that now.
That's chill of you, he says. I didn't think to do that.
I approach the elevator and peek over my shoulder at Rufus, this stranger who's following me. I don't feel uneasy, but I am guarded. He talks like we've been friends for a while, but I'm still suspicious. Which is fair, since the only things I know about him are that his name is Rufus, he rides a bike, he survived a tragedy, and he wants to be the Mario to my Luigi. And that he's also dying today.
Whoa, we're not taking the elevator, Rufus says. Two deckers riding an elevator on their end day is either a death wish or the start to a bad joke.
Good point, I say. The elevator is risky. Best case scenario, we get stuck. Worst case scenario? Obvious. Thankfully, I have Rufus here to be calculating for me. I guess last friends double as life coaches that way. Let's take the stairs, I say, as if there's some other option to get outside, like a rope hanging from the hallway window or one of those aircraft emergency slides. I go down the four flights like a child being trusted with stairs for the first time, its parents a couple steps ahead, except no one is here to catch me should I fall, or should Rufus trip and tumble into me. We get downstairs safely. My hand hovers over the lobby door. I can't do it. I'm ready to retreat back upstairs until Rufus moves past me and pushes open the door, and the wet late summer air brings me some relief. I'm even hit with hope that I, and only I, sorry Rufus, can beat death. It's a nice second away from reality.
Go ahead,
Rufus says. He's pressuring me, but that's the whole point of our dynamic. I don't want to disappoint either of us, especially myself. I exit the lobby, but stop once the door is behind me. I was last outside yesterday afternoon when I was coming home from visiting Dad, an uneventful Labor Day. But being out here now is different. I check out the buildings I've grown up with, but never paid any special attention to. There are lights on in my neighbor's apartments. I can even hear one couple moaning, the roaring audience laughter from a comedy special, someone else laughing from another window, possibly at the very loud comedy show, or possibly because they're being tickled by a lover or laughing at a joke someone cared enough to text them at this late hour. Rufus claps, snapping me out of my trance.
You get 10 points.
He goes to a railing and unlocks his steel-gray bike. Where are we going? I ask, inching farther away from the door. We should have a battle plan.
Battle plans usually involve bullets and bombs, Rufus says. Let's roll with game plan.
He wheels his bike toward the street corner.
Bucket lists are pointless. You're not going to get everything done. You got to go with the flow.
You sound like a pro at dying. That was stupid. I know it before Rufus shakes his head.
Yeah, well, Rufus says.
I'm sorry, I just... A panic attack is coming on. My chest is tightening, my face is burning up, my skin and scalp are itchy. I can't wrap my head around the fact that I'm living a day where I might need a bucket list. I scratch my head and take a deep breath. This isn't going to work. It's going to backfire on us. Hanging out together is a bad idea, because it'll only double our chances of dying sooner. Like a Decker hot zone. What if we're walking down the block and I trip and bang my head against a fire hydrant and... I shut up, cringing from the phantom pain you get when you think about falling face first onto spiked fences or having your teeth punched out of your mouth. You can do your own thing, but we're done for whether we hang or not, Rufus says. No point fearing it. Not that easy. We're not dying from natural causes. How can we try to live knowing some truck might run us down when we're crossing the street?
We'll look both ways, like we've been trained to do since we were kids.
And if someone pulls out a gun?
We'll stay out of bad neighborhoods.
And if a train kills us?
If we're on train tracks on our end day, we're asking for it.
What if...
Don't do this to yourself.
Rufus closes his eyes, rubbing them with his fist. I'm driving him crazy.
We can play this game all day, or we can stay out here and maybe, like, live. Don't do your last day wrong.
Rufus is right. I know he's right. No more arguing. It's going to take me some time to get where you are with this. I don't become fearless just because I know my options are do something and die versus do nothing and still die. He doesn't remind me that we don't have a whole lot of time. I have to say goodbye to my dad and my best friend. I walk toward the 110th Street subway station.
We can do that, Rufus says. I have nothing I'm gunning to do. I had my funeral, and that didn't exactly go as planned. Not really expecting a do-over, though.
I'm not surprised someone so boldly living his end day had a funeral. I'm sure he had more than two people to say goodbye to. What happened? I say.
Nonsense. Rufus doesn't elaborate.
I'm looking both ways, getting ready to cross the street, when I spot a dead bird in the road, its small shadow cast from a bodega's lit awning. The bird has been flattened. Its severed head is a couple inches away. I think it was run down by a car and then split by a bike. Hopefully not Rufus's. This bird definitely didn't receive an alert telling it that it would die tonight, or maybe yesterday, or the day before, though I like to imagine the driver that killed it at least saw the bird and honked their horn. But maybe that warning wouldn't have mattered. Rufus sees the bird, too.
That sucks.
We need to get it out of the street. I look around for something to scoop it up with. I know I shouldn't touch it with my bare hands.
Say what?
I don't have this dead is dead, so just walk away attitude, I say.
I definitely don't have this dead is dead, so just walk away attitude either, Rufus says, an edge to his voice.
I need to check myself. I'm sorry. Again. I quit my hunt. Here's the thing. When I was in third grade, I was playing outside in the rain when a baby bird fell out of its nest. I caught every second of it. The moment the bird leapt off the edge of the nest, spread its wings, and fell. The way its eyes darted around for help. Its leg broke on impact, and it couldn't drag itself to shelter, so the rain was pummeling it.
That bird had some bad instincts, jumping out of the tree like that, Rufus says.
The bird dared to leave home, at least. I was scared it was going to freeze to death or drown in a puddle, so I ran out and sat down on the ground with the bird, sort of shielding it with my legs, like a tower. The cold wind got the best of us, and I had to take off from school the following Monday and Tuesday because I'd gotten really sick.
What happened then?
I have no idea, I admit. I remember I got a cold and missed school, but I must have blocked out what happened to the bird. I think about it every now and again because I know I didn't find a ladder and return it to its nest. Sucks to think I left it there to die in the rain. I've often thought that helping that bird was my first act of kindness, something I did because I wanted to help another, and not because my dad or some teacher expected me to do it. I can do better for this bird, though. Rufus looks at me, takes a deep breath, then turns his back and wheels his bike away from me. My chest tightens again, and it's very possible I have some health problems I'm going to discover and die from today. But I'm hit with relief when Rufus parks his bike along the sidewalk, throwing down the kickstand with his foot. "Let me find you something for the bird," he says. "Don't touch it." I make sure no cars are coming from up the block. Rufus returns with a discarded newspaper and hands it to me. "Best I can find." "Thanks." I use the newspaper to scoop up the bird's body and its severed head. I walk toward the community garden opposite the subway station, set right in between the basketball court and the playground. Rufus appears beside me on his bike, pedaling slowly.
"What are you doing with that?"
"Burying it." I enter the garden and find a corner behind a tree, away from the spot where community gardeners have been planting fruit trees and flowers and making the world glow a little more. I kneel and place the newspaper down, nervous the head is going to roll away. Rufus hasn't commented on it, but I feel the need to add, "I can't just leave the bird out there to be tossed into a trash can or flattened by cars over and over and over." I like the idea of a bird that died so tragically ahead of its time, resting amid life here in the garden. I even imagine that this tree was once a person, some decker who was cremated and had asked to have their ashes packed into a biodegradable urn with a tree seed to give it life. "It's a couple minutes after 4, Rufus informs me. "I'll be fast." I take it he's not the bury-a-bird type. I know many people won't agree or understand this sentiment. After all, to most people, a bird is nothing compared to an actual human being, because actual human beings put on ties and go to work. They fall in love and get married, and they have kids and raise them. But birds do all of this, too. They work. No ties, you got me there. And mate, and nurture baby birds until they can fly. Some of them become pets who entertain children, children who learn to love and be kind to animals. Other birds are living until their time is up. But this sentiment is a Mateo thing, meaning it's always made others think I'm weird. I don't share thoughts like these with just anyone, rarely even with Dad or Lydia. 2 fists can fit in this plot, and I'm shuffling the bird's body and head off the newspaper and into the hole right when a flash goes off behind me. No, the first thing I thought wasn't that an alien was beaming down warriors to take me out. Okay, fine, it was. I turn to find Rufus aiming his phone's camera at me. "Sorry," Rufus says. "Not every day you see someone burying a bird." I scoop the soil over the bird, smoothing it flat before standing. I hope someone is this kind to us when it's over.
Rufus, 4:09 a.m. Yo, Mateo is too good. Definitely not suspicious of him anymore. It's not like he's got it in him to jump me. But I'm mad shocked to meet someone so pure. I wouldn't say I've only ever surrounded myself with assholes, but Malcolm and Tego are never gonna bury a bird in their lives. Let's be real fucking clear about that. Beating down that bastard Peck tonight proves we're not innocent. I'll bet you anything Mateo has no idea how to make a fist, and couldn't imagine himself getting violent. Not even when he was a kid and dumb shit was forgiven and written off because he was young. There's no way I'm telling him about Peck. I'll take it to my grave today. We ought to see who first.
My dad. We can take this subway, Mateo points. It's only 2 stops downtown, but it's safer than walking.
2 stops downtown would be a quick 5-minute bike ride for me, and I'm tempted to just meet him there. But my gut is telling me this Mateo kid will screw up and leave me hanging outside the train station. I carry my bike down the stairs by its handlebars and seat. I roll my bike around the corner while Mateo cautiously hangs back a bit. And I catch him peeking before following me. Like when I went to that haunted house thing in Brooklyn with Olivia a few years ago. Except I was a kid. I don't know what he's expecting to find. And I'm not asking either. You're good, I say. Coast is clear. Mateo creeps behind me, still suspicious of the empty corridor leading to the turnstiles. I wonder how many other Deckers are hanging out with strangers right now. A lot are probably dead by now. Car accident, or fire, or shot, or fallen down a manhole, or... He stops himself. Dude really knows how to paint a picture of tragedy. What if they were on their way to say goodbye to someone close to them, and then... Mateo claps. Gone. It's not fair. I hope they weren't alone. We get to the Metro card vending machine. Nope, not fair. I don't think it matters who you're with when you die. Someone's company isn't going to keep you alive once Deathcast hits you up. This has got to be taboo for a last friend to say, but I'm not wrong. Still feel a little bad when it shuts Mateo up. Deckers get some perks, like free unlimited passes for the subway. You just gotta bother the teller with some form. But the unlimited part is bullshit, because they expire at the end of your end day. A few weeks ago, the Plutos claimed we were dying so we could score free passes for our adventure to Coney Island, thinking the dude would give us a break and let us through. But nah, he had us waiting for confirmation from Deathcast servers, which can take longer than waiting for an express train, so we just bounced. I buy an unlimited Metro card, the non-Decker. I still got tomorrow's edition, and Mateo copies. We swipe our way into the platform. This could be our last ride for all we know. Mateo points back at the booth. Is it crazy to think the MTA won't need any train staffers in a few years because machines, maybe even robots, will take over their jobs? It's sort of happening already if you think about. The roar of the approaching train drowns Mateo out a little at the end there. But it's fine. I get what he's saying. The real victory here is catching a train instantly. Now we can safely rule out falling onto the exposed tracks, getting stuck while rats run by us, and straight chopped up and flattened by the train. Damn. Mateo's grimness is already rubbing off on me. Before the doors even open, I see one of those train takeovers going down. The ones where college kids host parties on trains to celebrate not getting the alert Mateo and I got. I guess dorm parties got old, so they're whiling out on the subway instead. And we're joining them, damn it. Let's go, I tell Mateo when the doors open. Hurry! I rush and wheel my bike in, asking someone to make room for us. And when I turn to make sure my back tire isn't keeping Mateo from getting in, I see he's not behind me at all. Mateo was standing outside the car, shaking his head, and at the last second before the doors close, he darts into the empty car ahead of mine. One that has sleeping passengers, and isn't blasting a remixed version of Celebration. It's a classic anthem, but let's retire it already. Look. I don't know why Mateo bitched out, but it's not going to ruin my vibe. It's a party car. I wasn't asking him to go bungee jumping or skydiving. It's far from daredevil territory. We Built This City comes on, and a girl with two handheld stereos hops onto the bench seat to dance. Some dude is hitting on her, but her eyes are closed and she's just straight up lost in her moment. In the corner, some dude with a hood over his face is knocked out. Either he's had a really good time, or he's a dead Decker on this train. Not funny. I lean my bike against an empty bench seat. Yeah, I'm that guy whose bike gets in everyone's way, but I'm also dying, so cut me some slack. And step over the sleeping guy's feet to peek into the next car. Mateo is staring into my car like some kid who's been grounded and forced to watch his friends play from his bedroom window.
I gesture for him to come over, but he shakes his head and stares down at the floor, never looking up at me again. Someone taps my shoulder. I turn, and it's this gorgeous hazel-eyed black girl with an extra can of beer in her hand. Want one? Nah, I'm good. I shouldn't be getting buzzed. More for me? I'm Callie. I miss that a little. Kelly? She leans into me, her breasts against my chest and her lips against my ear.
Tally!
Hey, Callie. I'm Rufus. I say back into her ear since she's already there.
What are you?
My stop is next, Callie interrupts. Want to get off with me? You're cute and seem like a nice guy. She's definitely my type, which means she's also Tego's type. Malcolm's type is any girl who likes him back. But since there isn't much I can offer her, besides what she's obviously suggesting, I gotta pass. Having sex with a college girl has gotta be on mad people's bucket list. Young people, married dude people, boys, girls, you get it. I can't, I say. I gotta have Mateo's back. And I also have Amy on the brain. I'm not trying to cheat that with something fake like this.
Sure you can.
I really can't, and it sucks, I say. I'm taking my friend to the hospital to see his dad.
Forget you, then.
Callie turns her back on me, and she's talking to another guy within a minute. Which is good on her, since he actually follows her out of the train when we come to her stop. Maybe Callie and that guy will grow old together and tell their kids how they met at a subway party. But I bet you anything they'll just have sex tonight and he'll call her Kelly in the morning. I take photos of the energy in the car. The guy who's managed to get the attention of the beautiful girl. Twins dancing together. The crushed beer cans and water bottles. And the freaking life of it all. I put my phone in my pocket, grab my bike, and wheel it through the doors between the cars. The ones the overhead announcements are constantly reminding us are for emergencies only. End day or not, that announcement can suck it. The tunnel's air is chill, and the train's wheels screeching and screaming on the rails is a sound I won't miss. I enter the next car, but Mateo keeps staring at the floor. I sit beside him, and I'm about to go off on him, to tell him how I didn't take some older girl's invite to have sex on my last day to live ever because I'm a good last friend. But it's pretty damn obvious he doesn't need that guilt trip. Yo, tell me more about these robots. The ones who are going to take everyone's jobs. Mateo stops looking at the floor for a sec, turning to see if I'm toying with him, and I'm clearly not. I'm mad chill on all this. He grins and rambles so hard. It's going to take a while, because evolution is never fast, but the robots are already here. You know that, right? There are robots that can cook dinner for you and unload the dishwasher. You can teach them secret handshakes, which is pretty mind-blowing, and they can solve a Rubik's Cube. I even saw a clip of a breakdancing robot a couple months ago. But don't you think these robots are one giant distraction, while other robots receive job training at some underground robot headquarters? I mean, why pay someone $20 an hour to give directions when our phones already do that? Or even better, when a robot can do it for you? We're screwed. Mateo shuts up and is no longer grinning. Buzzkill, right? Yeah, Mateo says. At least you won't have to ever worry about your boss firing you for a robot, I say. That's a pretty dark bright side, Mateo says. Dude, today is one huge dark bright side. Why'd you bail on the party car? We have no business on that car, Mateo says. What are we celebrating, dying? I'm not trying to dance with strangers while on my way to say goodbye to my dad and his best friend, knowing damn well there's a chance I may not even reach them. That's just not my scene.
and those aren't my people. It's just a party. The train stops. He doesn't respond. It's possible Mateo not being a daredevil will keep us alive longer. But I'm not banking on it being a memorable end day.
Amy Dubois, 4:17 a.m. Deathcast did not call Amy Dubois because she isn't dying today. But she's losing Rufus. Lost him already because of her boyfriend. Amy is speed walking home, followed by Peck. You're a monster! What kind of person tries to get someone arrested at their own funeral? I got jumped by three guys. Malcolm and Tago didn't touch you, and now they're going to jail. Peck spits. They ran their mouths. That's not on me. You have to leave me alone. I know you never liked Rufus, and he didn't give you any reason to, but he's still really important to me. I always wanted him in the picture, and now he won't be. I had even less time with him because of you. If I can't see him, I don't want to see you either. You ending it with me? Amy stops. She doesn't want to turn Peck's way because she hasn't considered this question yet. People make mistakes. Rufus made a mistake attacking Peck. Peck shouldn't have had his friends send the police after Rufus, but he wasn't wrong to have done so. Well, legally, no. Morally, hell yes. You keep putting him before me, Peck says. I'm the one you've been coming to for all your problems, not the guy who almost killed me. I'll let you think on that. Amy stares at Peck. He's a white teen with low-hanging jeans, baggy sweater, Caesar cut, and dried blood on his face because he's dating her. Peck walks away, and Amy lets him. She doesn't know where she stands with Peck in this world of gray. She's not quite sure where she stands with herself, either.
Mateo, 4:26 a.m. I'm failing to break out. I couldn't surround myself with more strangers. They were harmless for the most part, the only red flag being how I don't want to be around people who get so drunk they pass out and eventually black out the nights they're lucky to be living. But I wasn't honest with Rufus, because on a deep level, I do believe partying on the train is my kind of scene. It's just that the fear of disappointing others or making a fool of myself always wins. I'm actually surprised Rufus is chaining his bike to a gate and following me into the hospital. We walk up to the front desk, and a red-eyed clerk smiles at me, but doesn't actually ask how he can help me. Hi, I'd like to see my father, Mateo Torres, in intensive care. I pull out my ID and slide it across the glass counter to Jared, as the name tag pinned to his sky-blue scrubs reads. Visiting hours ended at 9, I'm afraid. I won't be long, I promise. I can't leave without saying goodbye. It's not happening tonight, kid, Jared says, the smile still there, except a little more unnerving. Visiting hours resume at 9. 9 to 9. Catchy, right? Okay, I say. He's dying, Rufus says. Your father is dying? Jared asks me, the bizarre smile of someone working a 4-in-the-morning shift finally gone. No, Rufus grabs my shoulder and squeezes. He is dying. Do him a solid and let him upstairs to say goodbye to his father. Jared doesn't look as if he particularly appreciates being spoken to this way, and I'm not a fan of it myself, but who knows where I would be without Rufus to speak up for me. I actually know where I'd be. Outside this hospital, probably crying and holed up somewhere hoping I make it to 9. Hell, I'd probably still be at home playing video games or trying to talk myself into getting out of the apartment. Your father is in a coma, Jared says, looking up from his computer. Rufus's eyes widen, like his mind has been blown. Whoa. Did you know that? I know that. Seriously, if it's not his first week on the job, Jarrett's got to be on some 40-hour shift. I still want to say goodbye. Jared gets his act together and stops questioning me. I get his initial resistance. Rules are rules. But I'm happy when he doesn't drag this out any longer by asking me for proof. He takes photos of us, prints out visitor passes, and hands the passes to me. Sorry about all this. And, you know, his condolences, while hardly there, are way more appreciated than the ones I received from Andrea at Deathcast. We walk toward the elevator. Did you also want to punch the smile off his face? Rufus asks. Nope. It's the first time Rufus and I have spoken to each other since getting out of the train station. I press the visitor pass across my shirt, making sure it sticks with a couple pats. But thanks for getting us in here. I would have never played the Decker card myself. No problem. We have zero time for could've, would've, should've, Rufus says. I push the elevator button. I'm sorry I didn't join in on the party car. I don't need an apology. If you're fine with your decision, that's on you. He walks away from the elevator and toward the staircase. I'm not cool with us riding the elevator, though, so let's do this. Right. Forgot. It's probably better to leave the elevators available to the nurses and doctors and patients at this time of night anyway. I follow Rufus up the stairs, and it's only the second floor, but I'm already out of breath. Really, maybe there's something physically wrong with me, and maybe I'll die here on these steps before I can reach Dad or Lydia or future Mateo. Rufus gets impatient and sprints up, sometimes even skipping two steps at a time. On the fifth floor, Rufus calls down to me. I hope you're serious about opening yourself up to new experiences, though. Doesn't have to be something like the party car. I'll feel ballsier once I've said my goodbyes, I say. Respect, Rufus says. I trip up the steps, landing flat on the sixth floor. I take a deep breath as Rufus comes back down to help me up. That was such a kid fall, I say. Rufus shrugs. Better forward than backward. We continue to the eighth floor. The waiting area is straight ahead, with vending machines and a peach-colored couch between folding chairs. Would you mind waiting out here? I sort of want one-on-one time with him. Respect, Rufus says again. I push open the blue double doors and walk through. Intensive care is quiet, except for some light chatter and beeping machines. I watched this 30-minute documentary on Netflix a couple years ago about how much hospitals have changed since Deathcast came into the picture. Doctors work closely with Deathcast, obviously, receiving instant updates about their terminal patients who've signed off on this agreement. When the alerts come in, nurses dial back on life support for their patients, prepping them for a comfortable death instead, with last meals, phone calls to families, funeral arrangements, getting wills in order, priests for prayers and confessions, and whatever else they can reasonably supply. Dad has been here for almost 2 weeks. He was brought in right after his first embolic stroke at work. I freaked out really hard. And before I went ahead and signed off on Dad's contact information being uploaded into the hospital's database, I spent the night of his admittance praying his cell phone wouldn't ring. Now, I'm finally free of the anxiety that Dr. Quintana might call to notify me my dad is going to die. And it's good to know Dad has at least another day in him. Hopefully way more than one. I show a nurse my visitor pass and bullet straight into Dad's room. He's very still, as machines are breathing for him. I'm close to breaking down because my dad might wake up to a world without me, and I won't be around to comfort him. But I don't break. I sit down beside him, sliding my hand under his, and rest my head on our hands. The last time I cried was the first night at the hospital, when things were looking really grim as we approached midnight. I swore he was minutes away from death. I hate to admit it, but I'm a little frustrated Dad is not awake right now. He was there when my mother brought me into this life, and when she left us, and he should be here for me now. Everything is going to change for him without me. No more dinners where instead of telling me about his day, he would go on remembering the trials my mother put him through before she finally agreed to marry him, and how the love they shared was worth it while it lasted. He'll have to put away the invisible pad he would whip out whenever I said something stupid as a promise to embarrass me in front of my future children, even though I never really saw kids as part of my future. And he'll stop being a father, or at least won't have anyone to parent. I release Dad's hand, grab a pen that's on his bedside chest of drawers, pull out our photo, and write on the back of it with an unsteady hand. Thank you for everything, Dad. I'll be brave, and I'll be okay. I love you from here to there. Mateo. I leave the photo on top of the chest. Someone knocks on the door. I turn, expecting Rufus, but it's Dad's nurse, Elizabeth. Elizabeth has been taking care of Dad during the night shift, and she's always so patient with me whenever I call the hospital for updates.
Mateo?
She eyes me mournfully. She must know. Hi, Elizabeth.
I'm sorry to interrupt. How are you feeling? Would you like me to call down to the cafeteria and see if they put the Jell-O out yet?
Yeah, she definitely knows. No, thank you. I focus on Dad again. How vulnerable and still he is. How's he doing?
Stable. Nothing for you to worry about. He's in good hands, Mateo.
I know. I tap my fingers on Dad's chest of drawers, where his house keys, wallet, and clothes are. I know I have to say goodbye. Never mind that Rufus is out there waiting for me. Dad never would have wanted me spending my end day in this room, even if he were awake. You know about me, right?
Yes.
Elizabeth covers Dad's skinny body with a new sheet. It isn't fair. I don't want to leave without hearing his voice. Elizabeth is on the opposite side of the bed, her back to the window while mine is toward the door.
Can you tell me a little bit about him? I've been taking care of him for a couple weeks, and all I know about his personal life is he wears mismatched socks and has a great son.
I hope Elizabeth isn't asking this because she doesn't think Dad will wake up to tell her himself. I don't want Dad dying soon after I do. He once told me that stories can make someone immortal as long as someone else is willing to listen. I want him to keep me alive the same way he did my mother. Dad loves creating lists. He wanted me to start a blog for his lists. He thought we'd become rich and famous, and that commenters would request special lists. He even believed he'd finally get on TV because of the lists. Appearing on TV has been a dream of his since he was a kid. I never had the heart to tell him his lists weren't that funny, but I liked seeing how his mind worked, so I was happy whenever he gave me a new one to read. He was a really great storyteller. It sometimes feels like whiplash, like I was walking on the Coney Island beach with him where he proposed to my mother the first time.
The first time?
Rufus. I turn and find him standing in the doorway.
Sorry to eavesdrop. I was checking in on you.
Don't worry about it. Come in, I say. Elizabeth, this is Rufus. He's my last friend. I hope he's actually telling the truth, how he wanted to see how I was doing, and not that he's here to say goodbye and suggest we go our separate ways. Rufus leans against the wall with folded arms.
So, this proposal?
My mother turned him down twice. He said she liked playing hard to get. Then she found out she was pregnant with me, and he got down on one knee in the bathroom, and she smiled and said yes. I really like that moment. I know I wasn't there, but the memory I've created in my head over the years is crystal clear. I don't know exactly what that bathroom looked like, since it was in their first shoebox-sized apartment, but Dad always commented on how the walls were a muted gold, which I always took to mean aged yellow, and he said the floor tiles were checkered. And then there's my mother, who comes alive for me in his stories. In this particular one, she's laughing and crying about making sure I'm not brought into this world a bastard because of her family's traditions. It never would have mattered to me in the long run. The whole bastard thing is stupid. Sweetie, I wish I could wake him up for you. I really do. Too bad life doesn't allow us to turn its gears like a clock when we need more time. Can I have 10 minutes alone? I think I know how I can say bye. Take your time, dude, Rufus says. It's surprising and generous. No, I say. Give me 10 minutes and come get me. Rufus nods.
You got it.
Elizabeth rests a hand on my shoulder.
I'll be out by the front desk if you need anything.
Elizabeth and Rufus leave. The door closes behind them. I hold Dad's hand. It's time I tell you a story for once. You were always asking me, begging me sometimes, to tell you more about my life and how my day was, and I always shut down. But me talking is all we've got now, and I'm crossing my fingers and toes and unmentionables that you can hear me. I grip his hand, wishing he'd squeeze back. Dad, I was raised to be honest, but the truth can be complicated. It doesn't matter if the truth won't make a mess. Sometimes the words don't come out until you're alone. Even that's not guaranteed. Sometimes the truth is a secret you're keeping from yourself, because living a lie is easier. I hum Take This Waltz by the late Leonard Cohen, one of those songs that never apply to me, but help me lose myself anyway. I sing the lyrics I do remember, stumbling over some words and repeating others out of place. But it's a song Dad loved, and I hope he hears me singing it, since he can't.
Rufus, 4:46 a.m. I'm sitting outside Mateo's father's room, and I'm charged with telling Mateo it's time to go. Getting him out of his apartment was one thing, but I'm probably going to have to knock the dude out and drag him out of the hospital. Someone would have had to do the same thing to get me away from my pops, coma or no coma. That nurse, Elizabeth, looks at the clock and then at me before carrying a tray of stale-smelling food into another room. Time for me to grab Mateo. I get up from the floor and crack open the door to the room. Mateo is holding his father's hand and singing some song I've never heard before. I knock on the door and Mateo jumps, straight startled. Sorry, man. You good? Mateo stands and his face is flushed, like we got into a snapping battle and I played him hard in front of mad people. Yeah, I'm fine. That's a damn lie. I should tidy up. It takes a minute before he lets go of his father's hand, almost like his father is holding him back. But Mateo manages to break free. He picks up a clipboard and drops it into a rack above his father's bed. Dad usually leaves all his cleaning for Saturdays because he hates the idea of coming home from work on weekdays to more work. On the weekends, we cleaned and earned our TV marathons. Mateo looks around, and the rest of the room is pretty damn clean. I mean, I'm not eating off the floor, but that's a hospital thing. Did you get your goodbye in? Mateo nods. Sort of. He walks toward the bathroom. I'm going to make sure it's clean in there. I'm sure it is. I should make sure they have clean cups ready for when he wakes up. They're gonna take care of him. He might need a warmer sheet. He can't tell us if he's cold. I walk over and hold Mateo by the shoulders, trying to still him because he's shaking. He doesn't want you here, okay? Mateo's eyebrows squeeze together, and his eyes get red. Sad red, not pissed red. I didn't mean it like that. I say stupid things. He doesn't want you wasting away here. Look, you got a chance to say goodbye. I didn't get that with my fam. I took too much time trying to figure out what I was gonna say. I'm happy for you, but mad jealous too, and if that isn't enough to get you out, I need you. I need a friend by my side. Mateo looks around the room again, no doubt convincing himself he definitely does need to scrub the toilet this very second, or to make sure every single cup in this hospital is spotless so his father can't end up with a bad one. But I squeeze his shoulders and wake him out of all of that. He heads over to the bed and kisses his father's forehead. Goodbye, Dad. Mateo walks backward, dragging his feet, and waves bye to his sleeping father. My heart is pounding, and I'm only a witness to this moment. Mateo must be about to explode. I place a hand on his shoulder and he flinches. Sorry, he says at the doorway. I really hope he wakes up today. Just in time, you know? I'm not betting on it, but I nod anyway. We leave the room and Mateo peeks in one last time before closing the door behind us.
Mateo, 4:58 a.m. I stop at the corner of the hospital. It's not too late to run back to Dad's room and just live out my day there. But that's not fair to put others in the hospital at risk of me, the ticking time bomb. I can't believe I'm back outside in a world that will kill me, accompanied by a last friend whose fate is screwed too. There's no way this courage will hold. You good? Rufus asks. I nod. I really want to listen to some music right now, especially after singing in Dad's room. I cringe because Rufus caught me singing, but it's all right. It's all right. He didn't say anything, so maybe he didn't hear that much. The awkwardness of it all makes me even more antsy to listen to music, to hide away with something that has always been very solitary for me. Another of Dad's favorites is Come What May, which my mother sang to him and Womb Me during a shower they took together before her water broke. The line about loving someone until the end of time is haunting. The same could be said for my other favorite song, One Song from Rent. I'm extra wired wanting to play it, especially as a Decker, since it's about wasted opportunities, empty lives, and time dying. My favorite lyric is, One Song Before I Go. Sorry if I pressured you to leave, Rufus adds. You asked me to get you out of there, but I'm not sure you meant it. I'm glad you did, I admit. My dad would want this. I look both ways before crossing the street. There are no cars, but there's a man on the corner up ahead tearing through trash bags furiously, as if there's a garbage truck approaching to steal them all away. It's possible he's searching for something he accidentally threw out, but judging by the split leg of his jeans and the grime on his rust-colored vest, it's safe to guess he's homeless. The man retrieves a half-eaten orange, tucks it into his armpit, and continues going to the trash bags. He turns toward us as we approach the corner. Got a dollar? Any change? I keep my head low, same as Rufus, and walk past the man. He doesn't call after us or say anything else. I want to give him some money, I tell Rufus, even though it makes me really nervous to do so alone. I go through my pockets and find $18. Do you have some cash to give him to? Not to be a dick, but why? Because he needs it, I say. He's digging through trash for food. There's a chance he's not even homeless. I've been duped before, he says. I stop. I've been lied to before, too. I've also made the mistake of ignoring others asking for help, and it's not fair. I'm not saying we should give him our life savings, just a few bucks. When were you duped? I was in fifth grade, walking to school. This guy asked for a dollar, and when I pulled out my 5 singles for lunch money, he punched me in the face and took it all. I'm embarrassed to admit that I was pretty inconsolable at school, crying so hard until Dad left work to visit me in the nurse's office to see how I was doing. He even walked me to school for 2 weeks afterward and begged me to be more careful with strangers, especially when money is involved. I just don't think I should be the judge of who actually needs my help or not. Like they should do a dance or sing me a song to prove they're worthy. Asking for help when you need it should be enough. And what's a dollar? We'll make a dollar again. We won't actually make another dollar. But if Rufus was smart, or paranoid, like I was, he should have more than enough money in his bank account as well. I can't read Rufus's face, but he parks his bike, hits down on the kickstand. Let's do this, then. He reaches into his pocket and finds $20 in cash. He walks ahead of me, and I tail after him, my heart pounding, a little nervous this man might attack us. Rufus stops a foot away from the man and gestures to me, right when the man turns around and looks me square in the eye. Rufus wants me to speak up. Sir, here's all we have on us. I take the 20 from Rufus and hold out the cash.
Don't play with me.
He looks around like I'm setting him up. Accepting help shouldn't make someone suspicious. Not at all, sir. I step closer to him. Rufus stays by my side. I know it's not a lot, and I'm sorry.
This is...
The man comes at me, and I swear I'm going to die of a heart attack. It's like my feet are cemented to a racetrack as a dozen cars speed toward me in colorful blurs. But he doesn't hit me. The man hugs me, the orange that was in his armpit dropping at our feet. It takes me a minute to find my nerves and muscles, but I hug him too. And everything about him, from his height to his thin body, reminds me of Dad.
Thank you. Thank you, he says.
He releases me, and I don't know if his eyes are red because he's possibly without a bed and really tired, or if he's tearing up. But I don't pry because he doesn't have to prove himself to me. I wish I always had that attitude. The man nods at Rufus and stuffs the cash in his pocket. He doesn't ask for anything else. He doesn't hit me. He walks off, his shoulders a little straighter. I wish I'd gotten his name before he left, or at least introduced myself.
Good call, Rufus says. Hopefully karma takes care of you later for that one.
This isn't about karma. I'm not trying to rack up I'm a good person points. You shouldn't donate to charity, help the elderly cross the street, or rescue puppies in the hopes you'll be repaid later. I may not be able to cure cancer or end world hunger, but small kindnesses go a long way. Not that I'm saying any of this to Rufus, since all my classmates used to mock me for saying things like that. And no one should feel bad for trying to be good. I think we made his day by not pretending he's invisible. Thanks for seeing him with me.
I hope we helped the right person, Rufus says.
Much like Rufus can't expect me to be instantly brave, I can't expect him to be instantly generous. I'm relieved Rufus didn't mention anything about us dying. It cheapens everything, doesn't it? If this man thinks we're only giving him everything we have on us because we may not have any use for it 10 minutes from now. Maybe he'll go on to trust others because he met us tonight. He definitely helped me out with that.